Okay, you guys are here, so we might as well begin. Hi. What do you want to say about what we're talking about?
We thought you were going to lead.
Yeah, we thought that you were going
to. I did.
He just led you.
More. But you heard what I had to say. Now you talk.
Well, here we are two generations past Stonewall. And, you know, the interesting thing is that, with a few exceptions, we really haven't matured as a community, and especially even in the gay evangelical community, you know, as much as, let's say, the thousands of years of the Christian church. And I would think that, you know, okay, we're a little more savvy, we're a little more on top of our game, we're a little more whatever. And, you know, gay culture in general has not gotten to the point where we're acting like adults sometimes.
Well, there's a great deal of truth to what you say, although I would say that we shouldn't really have expected much in the way of anything out of Stonewall. You know, I mean, Stonewall. People talk about Stonewall as starting it all. Of course, that is fiction. There was a homophile movement before Stonewall.
Well, there was megachurchial movement.
And I don't mean that. I mean, in America, there was the homophile movement, Lund and Mattachine and so forth. And as a matter of fact, in 62, I think Stonewall was what,
68.
In 62, I was pushing integration of homosexuality and Christian faith in the evangelical community, in the university and so forth. So Stonewall is just a kind of a PR thing.
Reference point.
It's a PR reference point, but it's not a historical reference point. So, as a matter of fact, even InterVarsity Press published in 1964 in this country, and it was a reprint of a book that they had published in England, basically supporting monogamous gay relationships. That was InterVarsity Christian Fellowship.
Really?
Evangelical. Margaret Evening wrote the book. So again, you know, I think it is important sometimes to go back and refresh our minds about some of that history, you know. Now, I certainly agree with you, a great deal of the spiritual GLBT movement is pretty abominable. Lots of New Agey stuff, lots of people involved that haven't really psychologically worked through their disappointment and their experience of abuse and so forth within their upbringing. But I think it's too bad because they should find a more effective way of becoming, you know, mature about that rather than constantly going over it and whining about that. Now, I do think, though, that an awful lot of very good stuff is happening with homosexuality vis-a-vis the evangelical world. Those of you who get the Record and Review from New York City, who gets it from us? Some of you get it from the West Coast, which they reprinted later on, a month or two. But if you get it from us, you've already gotten the summer Record Review. And for example, a couple of items in the news Calvin College, a solidly conservative Christian college. There's a drama professor there who's written a play being supportive of gay people, and that's being promoted within the campus community. Gordon College, where I've been invited to speak three times, and it's right up there with Wheaton as a good evangelical college. The college, some heterosexual students on the campus, polled some gay students on the campus to write of their stories, and I think it was about 13 of them wrote some very moving things, and the college printed them up in a little booklet and distributed it all around campus. And as a matter of fact, next summer at the East, we're going to have a young lady who is still only an undergraduate at Gordon, who had that idea and put it together, and she's heterosexual. And the dean of students' office was very supportive, and you know, and so forth. And even talked to the media when they heard about it. So there are those kinds of things that are happening, and both Justin Lee's GCN network, which pulls no punches about, you know, true blue gospel-centered site, you know. And Justin Cannon's new website called Something About Orthodoxy, where he makes a big point of saying, and he's also a 20-something person, you know, he's studying at an Episcopal seminary, and he makes a big point that if we're going to mature, as you're suggesting, then we really do have to you know, stop thinking that the only people that we can turn to are, and he says quite literally, the bishop spawns and people like that who do not, you know, they are not really Orthodox Christians, and stick with orthodoxy, theological orthodoxy. And marry that with an acceptance of homosexuality, which I think certainly can be done, as Jack Rogers indicated last night. It's seamless. People ask me, well, how did you come out way back in the early 60s? And I said, I did not struggle because I took the gospel seriously, and nothing trumps the gospel, including homosexuality. And so I think that the more we really take Orthodox theology seriously and forget trying to bolster our position with liberal theology, the better off we'll be. And that's what I would endorse. And more of the younger generation are doing that.
What would you say is your state, or the state of the art right now, from your perspective, as far as the evangelical gay Christian movement, as far as its effectiveness?
Oh, I think it's being very effective. The people who, and especially now with the internet, people who are scattered all over the world, even, and all in tiny little towns. Out there, you know, there was somebody who found Justin's site, and then he came to one of our connections out east. He was from a town in Pennsylvania called Pillow, Pennsylvania. Now imagine being gay and growing up in Pillow, Pennsylvania.
Population 37?
It was up near Penn State where I got my doctorate, and I had never heard of it. And
you'd been to the church, though.
No. That's a joke, you know. Some people who sleep in, they don't get up on Sunday morning to go to church, and they say they went to Pillow Presbyterian, Mattress Methodist, Bedside Baptist, you know, all that.
So they're probably in religion, Pillow Presbyterian.
Well, I asked him, you know, I couldn't resist. And I said, oh, something about Pillow Presbyterian, he went right over his head. But anyway, I think, you know, that what Justin is doing is reaching out to younger people, and what Justin Cannon I think is starting to do is going to do that, because he's another young guy. And also, I was mentioning this to Darlene, and I've observed this over the years. You know, when you think of the high caliber evangelical leaders that have accepted my invitation to speak at EC Connections. They are people, you know, like Jack Rogers and Rita Finger later tomorrow, and Dave Myers and Lou Smeeds and Nick Woltersdorf and Hendrik Hart and Phyllis Hart and just people who are major people in the evangelical world. None of them has been relieved of his or her duties at the institutions where they teach and so forth. Randy Ballmer, who has spoken out east, and he's going to be here next time, and he's one of the editors of Christianity Today. So these people are quality evangelical, bona fide evangelical leaders who are saying, they're giving their imprimatur, really, to what we're doing. And you compare that, really contrast that, with the ex-gay meetings in the summer. And what do you find there? What you find there is their keynoters are essentially leaders in the ex-gay movement from this town or that town or the other town. You don't see people of the caliber that we have here speaking. You don't see them there. So again, I think there's just so many indications that things are going the right direction. I mean, back in 80, we've had now 59 of these. This is the 59th connection. I've never repeated a speaker at the same conference. So that's a lot, and we've always had a woman and a man and me, whatever that is. And never repeated them at the same conference. Now that's a lot of evangelical leaders. And when I started out, I wondered, will there be enough? But I made sure that I said, we're not going to rotate three or four people, because then the people can just say, hey, you're not really evangelical. Nor are we going to reach out to the Spongs and those people. That would be self-defeating. So that's what we've done. Back when I started review, I wondered, is it going to be enough to review? Well, there's too much to review. And there are too many supportive evangelical leaders, more than we have slots to fill. So I think that, you know, if you tend to maybe hear the religious right, which shouldn't be confused with evangelicals, you get discouraged from that, and the media doesn't understand religion at all, so they push that. Remind yourself of some of the stuff that I'm mentioning, and that we try and keep up with by sharing in the record and review. Yeah.
Would you say that we're waiting for some of the older people to die off?
I'm not.
You know,
one of my clients in group a couple weeks ago said, Ralph, what are we going to do if something, something happens to you? I said, well, you just get together and talk about your problems and say, now, what would Ralph say?
I was just thinking that as the younger people are growing up from teenagers, et cetera, they're more hearing more accepting things about it, so it's no big deal. And as they step into positions of making decisions, it'll be a lot easier.
I do think so.
And then the other thing I was wondering about, with all the people that you've talked about, I sense that people that are interested in academia or think philosophically, et cetera, they might be very well aware of all this, but the mass of people are still maybe being led emotionally by, like the religious right and stuff like that.
Well, I'll tell you, there is a glass ceiling on the religious right. It only goes so far. And the more people come out in families, then the more what you're calling the sort of the broad swath of people have reason, you see, to change their minds. You see, in order for somebody to change his or her mind, that person has to have a reason to change the mind. Now, you all had a reason, at least one reason, to change your mind. How many of you would hold the position you do vis-a-vis homosexuality if you weren't gay or lesbian? You'd be out mowing the grass in the suburbs someplace and listen to the ball game or something. You know, I don't know.
Sounds like some gay guys.
On the other side. They're off. But I mean, I'm just saying, you had a vested interest. And so do parents of gay people and brothers and sisters of gay people and, you know, and so forth. And so that the more the general society changes and the more people are coming out and the younger people are, I'm having dialogue on the emails with people who are not quite where we are, but they are leaders in the evangelical world and they want to know. But they've met me and talked with me, and they see, well, I'm not some crazy, you know, person. And I think the more evangelical Christians do that, you know, and not be indistinguishable from, you know, circuit party people and, you know, that sort of a thing, the more, you know, we have something to present, and the more they see it. This happened in the evangelical world and church world in general with the issue of divorce. You know, it used to be people didn't get divorced. And then the more people got divorced, you know. I mean, Randy Ballmer, who is on the staff of Christianity and teaches religion at Columbia University, his father was a very conservative preacher and took pride in the fact that he had never had a case where anybody that he had married over his long history of being a minister had ever gotten divorced. And he sort of took pride in that, as he should. And then, of course, he married Randy and Randy's wife. And then Randy and his wife divorced. And so then later, when Randy met his present wife, and she asked Randy's father if he would marry them. And he thought about it and he said he would. Because he had, you know, he had a reason. See, as things happened, he died before the wedding, but before it's time for the wedding. But he said that he would, and so that has happened with divorce. It's happened with interracial marriages. It's happened with Catholics marrying Protestants, and you know, vice versa. That sort of a thing. So I do think that everything contributes to that, but I think we have to continue to help that process by making clear that there is a bona fide merger of strong evangelical faith and a committed monogamous homosexual relationship, because that's the only integration I'm interested in. You know, if anybody else is interested in something else, they should get involved with some other organization besides, from my point of view, EC. Yeah.
There was a couple of things when he was talking about the generational thing. Obviously, the generational thing is very real, but I think also one of the things that we deal with is that maybe the youngsters have no problem with the gay thing, but they have a problem with the church thing and the God thing. And generationally, I think the church is in a crisis in trying to become and stay relevant to the younger generation. That seems to be the bigger challenge with the younger generation, is that they're getting to the place of not really finding a need for God, or it's less of importance. And I think that's something that we have to look at, you know, in what we're doing, and I think all of our churches, but it goes beyond what we're doing. The mainline church has that same problem, too.
Well, the mainline church has the problem, I think, basically because the mainline church is not preaching the gospel. I'll tell you, the church that I go to now in New York City, 14 years ago, it didn't even exist. Redeemer Presbyterian, it's a PCA church, Presbyterian Church in America. Evangelical, not the main denomination. Every Sunday in New York City, in Gotham, we're called the Big Apple, right? As in Eden, right?
I mean, Manhattan is not known as an evangelical fortress.
No.
Every single Sunday at Redeemer Presbyterian, there are 5 worship services, 2,000 people in each. Most of the people in the pews or seats like this and so forth are 20-somethings and 30-somethings. There's strong expositional preaching, intelligent preaching. These are young professionals. And so if you know, people are hungry. I have some clients, they're sort of in the fast lane business areas and stuff like that, fashion and stuff. And, you know, they travel to Europe and they travel with people who are into just, you know, drugs and sex. And these people are hungry. They're looking for it in sex and drugs. I mean, he was at a big party, one of the Greek islands, a couple weeks ago, and there was a man and woman. They had a yacht there that they had brought over for the party, and the wife comes up to him and invites him back to the boat, you know, for a threesome, you know. And that's where a lot of people are. We have to give them an alternative. And, you know, places like Redeemer do, and I hope EC does, so that, you can reach out to your peers, you know, who think the only thing to do with gayness is to go to Palm Springs to a big circuit party. And,
Dr. Blair, yeah. I think I'd like to address that point, because, I mean, echoing what was just said, I find that when I meet, which is more often the case, non-Christian rather than Christian gay people, particularly in their 20s and 30s, those who have not had some sort of specific church background, when I try to, after we become friends, mm-hmm. slip into the conversation and share, they tend to react to the whole thing like, it's something from another planet. They, you know, when I went to MCC Toronto, which was going strong 20 years ago for 4 years, it got packed. And the age range was anywhere from 18 up to whatever. And now, if you go back there, the average age would be 40, 45 and up, which is fine, except that there are hardly any young people there anymore. And the gospel has, in my view, been withered down.
Oh, yes, I think so.
It's become very, so I'm not sure what it is.
In many MCs, I think that. Yeah. Well, you look, you have the advantage on the gay thing that. The people are going to church all over the country. Kids are going to church all over the country. They're growing up there. In the evangelical churches, not in the mainline. Now, statistically speaking, there are little gay people growing up there. See? When they take seriously that evangelical faith that they have, and they're going off to Christian colleges like crazy. Wheaton and Gordon and these places, and they're getting involved on the secular campuses like crazy with Campus Crusade and InterVarsity, stuff like that. Not with the Canterbury Club. Now the ones who start to recognize that they're gay, where are they going to get help? Until some of these other organizations come better up to speed on the gay thing, what are they going to do? Throw the baby out with the bath? Or are they going to learn that there is such a thing as GCN and Justin Cannon's site and EC so that we can welcome them in? Now, I understand that every single year out here, there's a huge bunch of people here for the first time. Where are they the next year? And I think some of them have been turned off in the past to some of the people who volunteered to do workshops and tried to work out their anger issues with their church upbringing, and turned these people off, and some other things that have turned people off. Because people come here and they think, should I be going to the ex-gay conference or the EC conference? And if they come here and they hear New Age, they're not going to come back. Or if they see other stuff that you can find in a nightclub or something like that, they're not going to come back. We have to provide for them what other places aren't providing. If we don't, we might as well close up shop. And anybody who doesn't like it should go elsewhere. There have been people. They want to change the name of the organization. Well, there are plenty of mainline GLBT, XYZ, whatever, organizations for these people. Amen?
Amen.
It's the gospel that we want.
It's the gospel not only that we want, it's the gospel that meets the need. That's what I was trying to say this morning. Yeah. It's only the gospel. We can talk all we want about having a safe space, safe place. The only safety is in that personal relationship with the Lord. When you think that God himself takes on all the stuff that gives us such a problem, takes all that sin and guilt and anxiety, all that stuff into himself on our behalf. What is better news than that? What, gay is good? Is that the better news? No. That's good news, but it follows from the other. Get priorities straight, see? Yeah.
Dr. Blair, I found it really, I'm a kind of a political junkie, and I found it amazing in following Mitt Romney's campaign. He's being embraced by people, you know, within the evangelical community and glad-handed in ways. I'm pretty amazed for anybody who knows really anything about Mormonism. What do you think that says about where the mind on mass is moving?
Well, I don't think it's really the evangelical world that is so much buying into him.
Even Dr. Dobson had a really
no, but Dobson, I don't consider him a spokesperson for evangelicals. He is a political, religious right animal, and quite a number of sociological studies have distinguished by questioning people, and that you can tease out the religious right and the evangelicals. And certainly you can tease out the people like the Dobsons and the Robertsons and those people who, I mean, that's their shtick, you know, and that's their whole thing. And there are people like that on the left, too. That's their shtick, you see. But they don't speak, either on the left or the right, for liberals over here or conservatives over here. They have their own little thing. I think that
the, you don't see evangelicals broadly.
Oh, I don't think so. No. As a matter of fact,
at the landscape of the Republican candidates, and because Mitt Romney is maybe more in their vein of lifestyle, like married forever, kids.
Oh, no. I think that they would be much more happy with Huckabee or Brownback. But neither of those candidates has any chance, you know. For other reasons, I mean, they're so not known. I think all of you are too young to remember Romney's father, who ran for president in my childhood. Did you even know that his father?
Yeah.
You didn't even know.
Yeah.
He was governor of Michigan.
Governor of Michigan. Yes, and he was president of American Motors. You know, Nash, Rambler, and Hudson, and
What? The gremlin.
You know, the horseless carriage. But I do think that a lot of people do admire not the theology of the Mormons, but the hard work ethic, and, you know, and that sort of thing. It's an ethic of hard work and clean living, and, you know, that sort of a thing. Back in 1972, I was doing 2 years of running some mental health programs on homosexuality around the country through the Homosexual Counseling Journal, which I founded and edited, and we had these mental health things, and, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers came, and the time we were in Salt Lake City, we usually had these at mental health places, you know, but in Salt Lake City, guess where we had it? First Baptist Church. If you're a Baptist in Salt Lake City, you've had it anyway, you know. You're a Gentile. You know, that's the lingo. And yet, the Mormons had a bigger and more effective social service network of service ministries in Utah than even the state of Utah had. So I do think that there are admirable things about them. And
but you don't see them as being more broadly accepted?
No.
Or
no, I think that there's a big problem for evangelicals with the Mormon thing, you know. When Ravi Zacharias, you know the Ravi Zacharias ministry, RCIM? Tremendous apologetics ministry. And talking about young people, he goes and he speaks at universities all over the country, all over the world, really. And kids pack the auditorium. And to debate, atheism and, and the trustworthiness of the gospel and so forth, he and his team. And for the first time since the late 19th century, a non-Mormon was invited to speak in the tabernacle in Temple Square, and it was Ravi. He got a lot of flack from evangelical supporters for accepting that. Now, he didn't. I mean, he told them he would agree to speak there if there were no conditions, you know, and he could speak the gospel. And they said, yeah, and that's what he did. But even that, he got a lot of flack about that. So I think I don't think people evangelicals can jump on the bandwagon if it really gets down to it more. No.
And I'll tell you what, the reason why I raised that question with you is if what I'm hearing in the popular media about the seeming more acceptance of a candidate like Mitt Romney to people on that ilk and everything, I would think maybe there's at least, do you probably sense a loosening up? Or
well, you know, I think that first of all, the media doesn't understand the fine points, you know.
You know, aside from the Robertsons.
In working, you know, in dealing with the media over the years too, I have found that, I mean, even somebody back in the old days, some of you maybe don't even remember Phil Donahue, you know. But do you remember Phil Donahue?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he was, you know, pro-gay and all that kind of stuff. But his producers and he would not stop the rebroadcast of a thing with what's his name, the old SDA ex-gay that was having sex with all the people that came to him.
Huh?
Colin Cook. Even when we told them, hey, you know, this guy's a fraud, the answer was, it's good television. So you have to, you know, you have to understand the cynicism in broadcasting and the soundbite mentality, you know, and that sort of thing. And when you come to try and explain to people in the media who are many times only in their 20s and 30s, you know, anyway, about the history and the theology and the difference between right-wing and evangelicals, I mean, I used to, back in the good old days, before I had, what do you call it? when people call in and they get a recording of me, you know.
Oh, answering.
Well, I had the answering service. You know, these ladies with their, you know, and people would call in for evangelicals concern, and then she would report to me, you know, somebody was looking for evangelicals. Never in all the years did any of them ever pronounce the word right, you know. So, I mean, you know, just people don't know much about things. So they, yeah. But I think, as I was saying before, the more a person has a reason to, you know, there are people, maybe their kid has a particular medical problem, and then they get interested in the charity for that medical problem, or, you know, that sort of thing. Well, on the gay thing, more and more people. Growing up, see, it's not like blacks who don't grow up in your family if you're white, you know, or, you know, whites don't grow up in your family if you're black. But gay people grow up in everybody's family.
So I talked about the theme of this vested interest.
Invested interest, exactly.
People often need to change their minds about something. No,
exactly.
One personally, how can that be extended more, and I'm asking for myself as well, so if anyone here, to the large evangelical non-gay community, how to convince them that they too, in fact, according to the gospel, have a vested interest in including all of God's people.
Well, we don't even have that responsibility. We don't need to, because they have the vested interest.
How would they know
then we need to let them know that we exist, you see, and that sort of thing. And in that way, the internet is
okay. All right.
The internet is wonderful, because then they put in, you know, evangelical and gay, and that's where people find us. But you don't have to spark their interest. If they have a loved one and they have to work this thing through, then they're going to have the interest, you know.
Okay, can I just interject again? We're here, as I was once some years ago in Vancouver, in a church of several hundred people, very evangelical and sincere people, and you find yourself in the sea of non-evangelical people as a gay person, and you don't know that there's even another gay person in that congregation. You know, apart from coming out to my loved ones, colleagues, whatever, but in that particular congregation, which I'm very committed to,
let them get to know you. Let them get to know you.
Yeah.
Let them get to know you. I know of some people who once, you know, I mean, if you walk up to somebody who doesn't have any background in understanding any of this, and in fact, in place of background in understanding, they have stereotypes in mind, and you say, "Hi, I'm homosexual," you see, well, they're going to, you know, impress into that ink blot everything that they think they know and don't know anything, you see. But if you just show up and get to know them, and you're a good guy, and they see you love the Lord, and you pitch in on what needs to be done, and, you know, that sort of a thing, then they begin to put two and two together. It's a very different experience. It's sort of like what Jack was talking about the two lesbians and the Southern Baptist preacher, you see? And I've seen that over and over and over again. Now, if people like Falwell, well, he's gone, but people like Dobson, for example, he'll never have a vested interest to change, because he has a vested interest in not changing. So you don't bother trying to convince him. I think that is silly.
Pick your battles.
I mean, the Scots have a very good saying: "Save your breath to cool your porridge." You see, and get on with working with some people that have a reason to listen to you. See, and they do have a reason to listen to you if they like you, and if they, you know, I mean, I guess I can say this. For a number of years, I haven't been there lately, but for a number of years, I went to the Founders Weekends at RZIM, Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, and basically as a guest of my uncle, and who was a big, you know, he's the guy who funded him and got him started. And so my uncle would have, maybe 300 other wealthy high roller contributors, you know, come together at a nice, in a nice resort, and he'd pay for it all, and listen to the Ravi Zacharias team, and hear Ravi, and some guest speakers, and that sort of thing. And then, of course, after the banquet on Saturday night, then we were supposed to bring out the checkbooks and write a check, you know. Well, I was there, and so sometimes I'd come down to breakfast and the beautiful dining room, and I'd sit down, and you know, just like here, you know, people say, "Oh, hello, how are you?" They'd look at my name tag, "Oh, Al Blair, New York City, huh?" And they'd say, "How did you hear about Ravi?" I said, "Well, my uncle is, you know, D.D. Davis." "Oh, really?" Because he was the guy who was hosting the whole thing. And so that gave me a leg up, you know, with them. And then they'd say, "What do you do in New York?" I said, "I'm a psychologist." "Oh, do you specialize in anything?" "Yeah, homosexuals. I deal with gay people." "Oh, isn't that interesting? Yeah. We understand that they're doing wonderful things with gay people these days." And I say, "What do you mean?" You know, and then they say, "Oh, no, no, I said that's not happening. You know, it's impossible to change." And so, "Oh, really?" You know, and then they would listen because I had some credibility, you know. I was my uncle's nephew, and I was there, and I was obviously interested in being there, and so on. And then sometimes they would even say, "Oh, could we talk a little further about this, you know, because we have a relative who is, you know, and so on." And they had reason. And I said, "Well, you know, there's a meeting." "Oh, forget about the meeting, you know, let's just have some more coffee here and talk, you know." That's what I think. And in all the time I was there on these weekends, I never heard Ravi or any of the team say any negative thing about gays, and nor in their literature. Now, there was, I have to admit, and I reviewed the book a couple of reviews ago, one of the women who is on the Oxford team did have a chapter in a book on is the Bible intolerant, saying, "No, the Bible is not intolerant about this and that and the other thing, and that on homosexuality is not intolerant, it's just that it's wrong," and, you know, that sort of thing. But that was published, you know, not by Ravi, but she's one of the team members. But that's the only negative thing on the homosexuality I've ever heard. So again, you know, people have a reason to listen and pay attention. And now with the internet, it's not hard for people to very quietly and without causing any stir with anybody find us. But it's very important that once they find us, we don't link to who knows what. I mean, I am such a believer in not linking that our Eastern EC website doesn't even link to ECWR. Because if we'd link to one, we'd have to, you know, so now I can just say, "No, we don't link to anybody." I tell people who want to link to us, or any of them want reciprocal link, I say, "It's hard enough to answer for myself." You know, that sort of calms them down. But, you know, there are some gay Christian sites that, you know, they're one click away from porno. Well, how is that going to come across with people who aren't sure that you can do the integrating, and they go to us and they're convinced they can't do the integrating? That's what's so important about having the right kinds of keynoters and the right kind of workshop leaders. Yeah?
Okay. I see sometimes as gay people tend to do to other people what they've had done to them in the churches, and sometimes they will treat others that are different than them a certain way. And a little while ago you said that if you aren't anonymous or have a different kind of view on religion, there are other places for you to go.
I don't think I was talking at that point about another view of religion, but I certainly non-evangelical theology, yes. You know, that
This is an evangelical organization.
Right. Yeah.
And on monogamy, my reasons for supporting monogamy are not from the Bible, because, as you know, there's polygamy and all kinds of things. But in an egalitarian society where people are expecting parity, it's crazy to think that you should have any qualms about endorsing monogamy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think that there's a qualm there, but what I'm wondering is, I don't think that we're going to invite people just to leave, because some people are starting their journey of reconciling. And
no, I'm talking about the people who want to change this organization.
Oh, okay.
You know, and want to finagle their way in to positions of leadership and make those changes. That's what I was talking about.
I just want to make sure we're not throwing people out, because they're not like us.
We're talking about people that are trying to water down the gospel
and
make it into something else in order to please a bigger
people. And a recent survey of just the general public found that the number one thing that people in general, believers, unbelievers, whatever, the number one thing that they think is necessary in marriage is fidelity, at 93% of people. And way down the list were other things, you know. If you've been to my workshops on dating and relationship and so forth, you know that I don't advocate monogamy for any biblical reason. I mean, I have non-Christian people in my psychotherapy practice that champion monogamy for the psychological reasons that I spell out. And
you mentioned earlier that you see a difference between evangelicals and the right. I'm curious, because a lot of times people see that as one and the same.
Right.
In your own mind's eye, how do you see the difference?
Yeah, but it's not only mine. I'm just reporting what the sociological studies show when they go into interviewing people. And, for example, the Barna research is quite good at that. And the Pew research is quite good at that. Gallup. George Gallup. And that is that the religious right is essentially certain lobbies. That's what it basically is. Those lobbies and their mailing lists. Now, that's a very thin sliver of the population. And they're all, you know, the people who contribute to Dobson contribute also to Pat Robertson, and, you know, it's just a lot of overlap. When you're talking about evangelicals, you talk about the masses, not only of just the megachurches, because while they're big congregations in total, you know, they're not that many when you think of all the little evangelical churches around the country. And there they find that the main thing that these people are interested in is gospel preaching and the saving of souls, they are against abortion, but I think that, again, I don't think you need to root an anti-abortion argument so much out of the scripture, but out of simple biology. And so, I would not say people who are against abortion should be considered religious right. You know, why should that be any more than people who are pro-gay should be considered religious left? It has nothing to do with it. So I think that the evangelicals, though, are more basically apolitical in that sense. whereas the religious right is quite political, just as the religious left is quite political. And yet there's a broad swath of liberal mainline congregations that aren't involved in the religious left. But you can check that out in the sociological studies that have been done, and they make a big distinction between the right and the evangelicals and the left and the mainline liberals. Yeah.
When you spoke about two things, the secret,
yeah,
philosophy,
yeah,
so forth, and then
I don't even give it that credence, you know.
It
philosophy,
really,
please, you know, it's the marketing of wishful thinking, right, you know. Wish something and it's there. And of course, the downside of that idea is, you know, wish for a Cadillac and you got the Cadillac. Yeah, I don't see it. And but if you think of various negative things, they'll come true too. The universe is impersonal. But it's nonsense. Anyway, go on.
And comparing and contrasting, bringing up all the other religions, Buddhism, Muslim, mm-hmm, so on, and what they espouse. And also, in speaking of that, I've come across, I know I have colleagues and so forth, a preacher's son is now agnostic, talks about how anyone could be monotheistic these days, it's ridiculous, and so forth, and so on. And a Roman Catholic, person who grew up Roman Catholic who is now Buddhist, I know what you've said about just show up and be who you are, but when you get so much, well, that's your truth, that's the, you know, relativism, relative truth, and so forth and so on, for me it's very difficult, because
yeah,
I get back to the, how do I know? But I know that Jesus, because Jesus said, I am the one. But how do I, in my own mind, and maybe possibly in discussion with them, debate that?
Well, it is very difficult. It is very difficult because they have grown up saturated with postmodernism as a way of looking at the world. Now, that is nonsense. Postmodernism is easily dismissed. If you have some philosophical sophistication, but people like you're describing have no philosophical sophistication. So, I mean, the level of their sophistication philosophically has been derived from watching Oprah or something like that, you know. And so, you know, you have to begin at such a fundamental level, you know, in terms of the law of non-contradiction, and, you know, I mean, they say, well, there is no absolute truth. Well, hello, what did you just mean for me to take from what you just said? There is no absolute truth. You mean what you just said, you mean to be the truth, right? Well, yes. Well, there's no absolute truth except that absolute truth. Yeah. You're not. So, I mean, they're so naive. They don't get it. So you do have, so, but I do think that you earn, the only way you can earn an audience with them, though, is not to blast them, but to befriend them, and then let them see, hey, here's a good guy who also says he's a serious Christian, and, you know, and that sort of thing. And, can't understand that. That's not like what I grew up with, you know. And let them kind of maybe drool for a while, you know. And then, you know, say, oh, you want to know about them? I'll tell you sometime, you know. Let them see that there's a reason to refute, because just as the former Muslim that I quoted at the university conference knows,
They know it doesn't work. I mean, look, when you see people like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens write such nonsense, when they're all quite intelligent in their own field. But obviously, psychologically speaking, they're coming from all kinds of emotion, of hating religion, hating Christianity, and you know, Richard Dawkins wrote a good book, Selfish Gene. He was in his field. He doesn't know 1, 2, 3 about religion. And so constantly is attacking straw men. Same with Christopher Hitchens. He's a good writer, but he doesn't know 1, 2, 3 about what he's talking about. But he has, you know, an entertaining way of speaking, and so he's on.
Particularly strong trend in our postmodern society anyway, that somebody who happens to be well-known or famous for whatever reason, or infamous as it were, like Paris Hilton, if they say something,
yeah,
or they do, that becomes somehow a precedent. Or
yes.
Why do we pay so much attention to that?
Well, there is, in fact, an error that is formally recognized as transferring, you know, from authority, as, you know, like, well, Linus Pauling, you know. He knew what he was talking about in one area, and then all of a sudden he became a guru for vitamin C, you know, or the same way with Dawkins. And, well, Sam Harris, he hasn't established himself really in anything, but Dawkins has, and Christopher Hitchens has. And yet, you know, they write a book against God, and you know, and they both basically are confusing Islamist terror ideology, which is really basically Marxist. A very good analysis has been made of that. Has nothing to do with Islam. And so then they extrapolate from that to all monotheism and Jesus and so forth. So I think that, again, you know, you're not going to argue somebody into the kingdom, you're not going to beat them over the head, but if you demonstrate that the Lord really is real in your life, and then sometimes you can even speak about it, you know, as St. Francis said, preach the gospel, sometimes use words. Now, that, I think, sometimes is a cop-out, because even the statement, you know, preach the gospel, sometimes use words, uses words, you see. So it doesn't get you off the hook for giving a verbal witness, but you know, they're hungry. They are hungry. They are buying into all kinds of nonsense. If you are living by something that isn't nonsense, they want, it's their own need that will propel them. Now, there is, the Bible tells us, there is something about the gospel that people will resist. But that's evidence, you see. But if they get defensive and they're resisting, guess what? Something's happening. It's out of indifference that you know nothing's happening. But if there's resistance, it's like I tell my clients when they're having an argument with somebody about anything, you know, about what we're going to eat tonight. You know, it was your turn to scrub the bathroom. You know, if they see defensiveness, they can stop talking. They've gotten through. But no, most people don't do that. You know, and they read the defensiveness as the guy doesn't really believe them, or believe what I'm saying. The defensiveness says the person does believe what I'm saying. So save your breath. Anybody else? Oh, does that answer?
Yes, it does. And in that along those veins, I mean, this may be seem like a horrible generalization and so forth, but thinking of all the world's religion other than Christianity, would you consider them nonsense in that way?
Well, see, I mean, no, I mean, within the parameters of the presuppositions of any system, you can have consistency. See,
So, I mean, that is why we really need revelation. We can't, we can't build the foundation out of which then to build something consistent, theoretically or philosophically. And Christianity does not. Christianity is rooted in revelation, comes from outside, the bird's eye view, as it were. But you can be a consistent or inconsistent Hindu or Buddhist or Muslim or Christian, but at least we as Christians understand that our faith is rooted in God's revelation, see, in God's revealing himself. Now, of course, Muslims believe that God revealed himself through Muhammad and so forth. But I think, again, if you really want to start to do the study of the evidence for, the revelation and so forth, then you see that it just doesn't hold up. I mean, there's no way that you can compare favorably the Quran with the biblical literature. No way. And any of the other, religious literature. And a lot of times people think, well, we don't even know if... I mean, there are actually people still say, we don't really even know if Jesus ever existed. Christopher Hitchinson said this the other night on TV. I don't know if he was even a historical figure. Well, I mean, that is really ridiculous. There is more evidence for the resurrection than almost anything in history. Because there's such a thing as a significant intervening variable. How do you account for the change in people? The totally, numbskull disciples prior to the resurrection and after. Okay. Spawn would say, well, you account for it because, they just got together and they remembered how nice it was to have him here, and it was just as though he was here. Well, that doesn't get anybody through martyrdom, separated from all the other brothers. And there is absolutely, no problem with the apologetic for Christian orthodoxy. But the problem is ignorance. People don't even know. And Christians don't even know this stuff, you see. But that's why, I think it's a great thing to go on and do some reading in the RZIM website and other apologetic. There are plenty of great books out there, good stuff to read.
What do you think of Mere Christianity by C.S.
Lewis? Oh, that's very good. It's a little dated in its vocabulary and that sort of thing, but it's excellent. Yeah. Excellent, yes. Yeah. But there are people who talk a little more our language today that are brilliant. I mean, Daryl Bach of Dallas Seminary in Biblical Studies, excellent. And Tom Wright, the Anglican Bishop of Durham, great New Testament scholar. Alistair McGrath in tackling Dawkins' book. He calls it I forget what he calls it. He and his wife. His wife is a psychologist, I think. And they both and he has his doctorate in both biology and theology. And
Dr. Blair. You're familiar with John Stott?
Yeah.
Right.
And you said it right. It's John Stott.
Yes. John Stott. Yes. I once attended a debate about 10 years ago between him and Bishop Spawn. At a church in
Vancouver. Oh my goodness!
It was quite interesting. If there were a winner, if there has to be one, I suppose it would have been Stott, because Spong really came out with a lot of liberal theology, and I found that even some of the, because there were a number of the gay Christians in attendance, found it difficult to swallow. And he was sort of dismissed for that reason by a lot of the non-gay Christians too, because his reputation preceded him of being very liberal and out there, and they didn't know.
And bright, and he's not. He's just sort of an angry guy.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if you've ever yourself had a conversation with John Stott or any communication, because he is compassionate, but certainly not of the same way of thinking as the evangelical conservatives about being gay.
Right.
And I think that hopefully was challenged at some point.
The only personal contact I've had with John Stott was, you know, he's sort of closing down and retiring, and he's not going to be speaking publicly anymore and so forth. So his secretary sent me a nice little note asking that we stop sending the Record and Review to John Stott. So that was the only contact I've had with him. But he's a gentleman and a very well respected person. See, and that, I mean, David Brooks, who's Jewish, who's a columnist in the New York Times, lamented, you know, that because John Stott spoke in New York City a couple years ago, and I think the headline on the editorial on the op-ed page, David Brooks was John Stott who, you know, because he lamented, and he's as I say, Jewish, not Christian, and he said it's just a shame that the media, if they want something from an evangelical, they will run into Falwell or something, you know. Mm-hmm. Instead of going to, you know, the major, you know, evangelical preacher of the 20th century, in a sense, was John Stott. And same way with other people. And on Dawkins, they could go to Alistair McGrath and, you know, people like that, or Ravi. And sometimes they do, but, you know, they like anybody else, they're lazy. So they go immediately to...
sensationalism.
Yeah, exactly. And they want this... But what happens, you've got, you know, on Larry King or something, you get Falwell and some, you know, crazy gay activists, and they're not talking to each other, they're, you know, but it's good TV, you see, that's the producer's point of view.
So. But they're running out of people to go to as they die off, as Falwell or whatever, and so what is interesting in Mel White's new book that's out, I thought it was interesting as the evangelicals are pegging Rick Warner to take over the life for Billy Graham, as kind of the preacher for preachers, as Billy Graham has been in the middle of the road over the years. And I had the pleasure of going to their conference, of the World AIDS conference last year, and got a chance to talk to Rick and Kay. And they do get it. They, because they have been educated on AIDS by the gay community of Orange County, Kay herself stood in front of the 5,000 people there and said, God has showed me the stereotypes and the prejudices and some really ugly things about myself. And on a one-on-one that I had with her, I said, I can see that you get this. And she said, we are getting it. Please continue to pray for us. And I fully see the Rick and Kay Warrens coming to EC or some of these other conferences someday, because right now they're under a huge pressure just dealing with the AIDS issue from the church.
Yeah. Well, you keep working on them because they, you know, and I don't mean on them, but with them, because they see in you a fellow Christian, and one of the good things about Rick Warren, of course, is that unlike some other people, and let's face it, you know, you have to watch the bottom line and so forth, and with Rick Warren, his books have done so well that he, you know, I think they pay him at the Saddleback Church $1 a year or something like that, you know. Sort of like Mayor Mike in New York City. Does all that work for us for a dollar. It's wonderful. And but, you know, when you don't have the economic baggage, and I think that's one of the problems with a lot of small churches where there's an evangelical minister who may quietly support some gay people who come to him and talk with him, but... what's he going to do if he gets fired and then he can't get a job in any of the other churches in his denomination, and he has two kids to put through college, and, you know, that sort of thing. So, but with the Warrens, I think that there's a good possibility of coming around. But that's just another example of how more and more people are indeed coming around. And
And that is good. And I know of others who I'm not at liberty to say their names, but they're coming around too. And so I have no doubt that it's all going in the right direction. You see, I mean, if I were involved with the ex-gay movement, I would be really discouraged, because I would think not only does it not work, but you know, they really get anybody to support it anymore. And so the future is I would say quite bright. You know, when you take the long haul, you know, that's what you always have to do. I tell people, you take the long haul. I've had the long haul from, you know, the 60s, early 60s. I've always been a rebel. I almost got kicked out of Bob Jones University for standing up for Billy Graham.
Well, who would have thought that 10 years ago that Rogers would have written that book?
Well, yes, true. We've had any number of people who, you know, they definitely changed their minds, you know, over the years before. I mean, many of our keynoters couldn't have keynoted 1980 when we started. Jack wouldn't have, you know. And so.
How did you recognize him on that plane?
I just recognized him from a Fuller catalog, I think, or something like that. So I said, hey, aren't you Jack Gardner? Have a seat. So, okay, well, it's 10 minutes before the next one, so. Bye-bye.
Thank you.